Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
Welcome. This is The Interpreter Radio. I'm your host, Martin Tanner, tonight. We have a fun show in store for you. We have a Come Follow Me on sections 111 through 114 of the Doctrine and Covenants. And for the first hour, I wanted to go over a topic that I've always found fascinating, and that is the information about Book of Mormon geography. And that particular topic is of special interest to me because I've had a number of discussions about it with people who think all the events in the Book of Mormon happened in North America, which I find quite implausible. I've discussed this with a number of people, including people from the Firm Foundation group, and as a matter of fact, I even did a presentation with a different point of view at one of their conferences in the last in the last year. And so this is something that to me is of real interest, and it's something that I wanted to go over tonight. I guess the short way to title what I'm going to talk about here is evidence for the Mesoamerican theory and the reasons why the North American theory of the Book of Mormon locations just really doesn't work. Before I jump into that, I wanted to preface my remarks by saying this is not the major point of the Book of Mormon, to find out where it was located. If it were, the church would have taken some official stand. They have not. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has always taken the position that the most important aspects of the Book of Mormon are the message of the book. And yet, for some reason, there's a huge amount of infighting on the issue of where these events took place. And because that seems to be so important to so many people, I wanted to talk about it briefly during our broadcast tonight. I'm Martin Tanner. This is Interpreter Radio, sponsored by the Interpreter Foundation, which is involved in scholarship, research, and defending the LDS faith against critics. We provide information to those who are seeking answers to questions, and we provide information that will also help strengthen the testimony of others. Please go to the Interpreter Foundation's website. It's easy to find. You just Google Interpreter Foundation, it will come right up. You will find Come Follow Me lessons, Interpreter Radio, scholarly articles, peer-reviewed articles, which have been published for years and years and years now, month after month after month. So, a wonderful, wonderful treasure trove of information, if you will take advantage of it. And it's all free of charge, available online. I'd also like to mention LDSAgents.com, which is a wonderful website, of course. LDSAgents.com is kind of the dead giveaway there. It's a group of Latter-day Saints realtors who will help you buy or sell a home, no matter where your home is located in the United States and Canada. They will find just what you're looking for. They can help you find a new home that's close to a temple, to a ward, or to special needs perhaps for your children. Whatever the need is, go to LDSAgents.com. They have your back. They have your values. And they are fair and honest. LDSagents.com. Highly recommend it. All right, to our topic at hand. And that is a brief look at some of the top scientific, linguistic, anthropological, geographic, and other evidences which support the Book of Mormon and also help people understand why it is that the Book of Mormon events happened in Mesoamerica. Now, nobody can say with absolute certainty, but there is a huge amount of evidence to support that. And let's just jump into some of those. If you follow the Book of Mormon narrative, it describes Lehi and his party, after Ishmael became involved, going south. And from there, they get to a place called Nahom. And that place is mentioned in 1 Nephi chapter 16, verse 34. And one might ask, if you're thinking about geography, is this place, Nahom, a real location? Because this obviously is not an English word. It's not something that Joseph Smith would have known. So there are two possibilities. Did Joseph Smith just make up the word Nahom? Or is this a location that happens to be real, that he received through inspiration, because it certainly wasn't available to him from any other source? The short answer to this issue or this question that's raised by the word Nahom in 1 Nephi 16:34 is that a location has been found that says Nahom, and it's found in a location that corresponds with the location mentioned in the Book of Mormon. Now, I have before me, which I obviously can't show you over the radio, some of the actual inscription that says Nahom, which is on an ancient altar that is south of Jerusalem and dates to the proper time period. Coincidence? Perhaps, but I think not. If we follow Lehi's trail from Nahom, which is the place where Ishmael died and was buried, then you find that they travel almost directly east, and they reach a place that's called Old World Bountiful. It's described in 1 Nephi chapter 17, verses 5 and 6, and in 1 Nephi chapter 18, verse 6. In those verses and in the surrounding verses, we read about a bountiful place, hence the name Old World Bountiful. And it describes water, fresh water. It describes vegetation. It describes fruit. And it describes metal and timber, meaning trees large enough to obtain wood from them, sufficient to make a ship, and other things that one doesn't necessarily associate, or one does not associate at all, with the vast desert, which is the Sahara Desert on the Arabian Peninsula. This is just not a place where anyone in Joseph Smith's era, or even today, if they're not well educated on this particular issue, would think that there's any that there's any location that could be described as bountiful. And so this bountiful location is described by Joseph Smith as being lush with vegetation, but located geographically where on a map everyone would say there is just an ever-stretching area of rocks and sand, mostly sand. So again, we ask the question, how would Joseph Smith come up with this? Was he just terrible at coming up with ideas? Maybe he didn't know the Arabian Peninsula was just sand and rock. Or maybe he was inspired. Perhaps. But how would we know if he were inspired or not? The real answer is, can we find a location, a real-world location that has the information described in 1 Nephi 17, verses 5 and 6? The answer is, there are two locations. One of them was originally found by Warren and Michaela Aston, Bade Sayak. The other one was found a bit later by George Potter and Timothy Sidar, and it's known as the Lala. Both of these locations are in the place described in the Book of Mormon, and they meet all of the requirements described in the Book of Mormon for Old World Bountiful. They were east of Nahum, just like 1 Nephi chapter 17, verse 1 mentions. They were on the coast, exactly like 1 Nephi 17, verse 5 describes. They were fertile with, quote, much fruit and also wild honey, close quote, and also small game, like we read about in 1 Nephi chapter 17, verses 5 and 6. They had enough timber to build a ship, as we read in 1 Nephi 17, verse 8. Fresh water had to have been available. Otherwise, Lehi and his party couldn't have survived there. We also know that Nephi went into a mountain to pray often, as we read in 1 Nephi 18, verse 3. There are cliffs that overlook the ocean, and there are mountainous areas just to the north of this coastline. So we have all the requirements, even the ocean cliffs where Nephi's brothers attempt to throw him into the depths of the sea, like we read in 1 Nephi 17, verse 48. We also find in both of these locations ore and flint necessary to make tools and build a ship, as we read in 1 Nephi 17, verse 9. And we also know from the Book of Mormon, or we can imply, that no one was living there at the time of Lehi's arrival. And another requirement also implied is that wind or ocean currents at that location must be capable of carrying a ship out into the ocean, as was described in 1 Nephi 18, verse 8. And as it turns out, all of these things are found in Wadi Sayak, found in 1994, and also in Salalah, found in 1999. I remember for the first time seeing the original photos that the Astons brought back, and it was incredible. Now we have satellite photos that also support and back up the ideas that were first mentioned by Warren Aston. This is absolutely remarkable because this is a confirmation that information in the Book of Mormon, unavailable to Joseph Smith, is indeed correct. That's very strong. Now, the next issue that comes up is, if one were to undertake an ocean voyage and you were to start from the southern edge of the Arabian Peninsula, where would the wind and the currents take you? There are two possibilities. One is south, directly south, around the southern tip of Africa and then over towards either what is today New England or Central America. The other one would be to go east around India through the various islands, New Guinea and so forth, that's north of Australia and across the Pacific Ocean. I would suggest that the latter possibility is by far the most likely for a number of reasons. The first one is the Nephites took the exact route that was taken by the Jaredites earlier. And if you look at the Jaredite record, it took them almost an entire year to get there. The directional possibility of going east would take much longer, but the currents would be less hazardous and much easier to navigate. And so that easterly direction seems to more closely fit the idea that the Jaredite barges and the ship built by Nephi went south and then around the southern tip of Africa, which is some of the most treacherous and dangerous ocean in the world, is just highly unlikely. Could special weather have been provided by God? Of course, but we have no description of that in the Book of Mormon, and this is truly hazardous ocean. There are routinely, when the I don't remember how many years apart, every several years, there are one-man races, sailing races around the world. And every year, a number of lives, every year that the race is conducted, there are a number of lives that are lost off from the southern tip of Africa because it is such hazardous ocean. That seems to me highly unlikely to be the place where where the Nephites went. They certainly went east. It just makes sense. They would not have gone south around the southern tip of Africa. All right, let's move on and ask, well, how could there be a Hill Cumorah in Mesoamerica and another one by the Smith family farm? This is a question that's asked all the time. And I actually find it kind of fascinating that that's brought up so often. But here's the short answer. If you say, how many state streets are there in the United States? How many Washington Boulevards are there in the United States? How many Las Vegases? You will find that there are at least two of those, one in Nevada and one in New Mexico. These kinds of the idea that there could be two places with the same name in and of itself is not remarkable, but also the Hill Cumorah is not a phrase that was ever used by Angel Moroni or by Joseph Smith until much later. This was originally described as the hill where the plates were located. It was not described as Hill Cumorah. And so the idea that somehow there was a Hill Cumorah as described in the Book of Mormon in Mesoamerica, and then Moroni brought the plates clear up to what's now upstate New York, is certainly not far-fetched. Marco Polo traveled in 24 years over 28,000 miles as he went from his home to various places in the East and in the Far East. From the time of the final Nephite battles described in Mormon chapter 6, verses 5 through 15, which happened in about 385 AD, we have 36 years at least to approximately 421 AD, according to Moroni chapter 10, excuse me, verses 1 and 2. That is plenty of time for Moroni to move the plates from somewhere on the Mesoamerican area up to what is now upstate New York. Not difficult at all. Plenty of time and easy to happen. Let's take a look at some of the other things that point to the idea that Mesoamerica is the most likely location for the events that happen in the Book of Mormon. One of the most important of these is language and counting conventions. In French, someone would say 420s and 12 if they wanted to say 92. In Danish, if you wanted to say the number 92, you would say 4.5 times 20 plus 2. There are different conventions. In English, counting is in dozens or base 10. For instance, people will often say something is cheaper by the dozen, or they will say something like 3 decades or some kind of a similar comment. Maybe some other examples would be thousands are left homeless, or hundreds without electricity, or millions plan to vote. Those are all things that are base 10. Mesoamerican counting system is one of the more complex in the world, and it's a base 20 system. Now, how would Joseph Smith possibly know that? Or could he know that? I think the short answer is, in his era, he could not have known that. And yet, we find in the Book of Mormon often the phrase that 20 years had passed away, or that 200 years had passed away, or that 400 years had passed away. Samuel the Lamanite warned the Nephites that one Bakhtun shall not pass away before they would be smitten, in Helaman 13, verse 9. And here I am inserting the Mayan words rather than the English ones in the Book of Mormon text. Nephi and Alma gave the same Bakhtun prophecy. Moroni recorded its fulfillment as he says farewell just after the first Khatun of his final Bakhtun, or 420 years after the sign was given of the coming of Christ. Moroni chapter 10, verse 1. So we see that the Book of Mormon counts in 20s and multiples of 20. Joseph Smith could not have known Mayan counting was base 20. It's absolutely impossible. Mayan glyphs and counting weren't really deciphered until the 1970s. This is a very recent formulation. Now, another issue that to me is quite telling is the discussion of leprosy among the Nephites, mentioned by Jesus. In 3 Nephi chapter 17, verses 7 through 9, Jesus says to the Nephites, "Have ye any sick among you? Have ye any that are lame or blind or halt or maimed or leprous? Bring them hither, and I will heal them. For I have compassion upon you. My bowels are filled with mercy. International leprosy expert Jesus Chico stated that indigenous populations in Mexico suffered from leprosy before the arrival of Cortes, because leprosy was identified by the Spanish in 1519. Confusion with other diseases would be quite unlikely. And not only that, the first leprosarium was opened in Mexico City by the Spaniard conqueror Hernan Cortes in 1521. The point here is that there was leprosy in Mesoamerica. Leprosy in Mesoamerica pre-Spanish, pre-Columbus. No European explorer or any later colonist ever mentioned or described a case of leprosy or any condition that can be confused with it among Native Americans anywhere in North America. So how could North America fit as a location for the Book of Mormon? Short answer, it couldn't. No leprosy in North America before Columbus. Leprosy in Mesoamerica was there before Columbus. That's the bottom line. Here's another evidence directly from the Book of Mormon that's clear when it's read carefully, but that is often rejected by those who believe in the North American point of view. The River Sidon flows north. It can't be the Mississippi or Missouri River. Here's what we read in Alma chapter 16, verse 6. Behold, the Lamanites will cross the River Sidon in the south wilderness, away up beyond the borders of the land of Manti. And behold, there shall ye meet them on the east side of the River Sidon. So up in the south is where the Nephites are to meet the Lamanites to fight. Up in the south does not quite work with the Mississippi River or with the Missouri River. Let's take a look at another closely allied verse, Alma chapter 22, verse 27. The land of Nephi was divided from the land of Zarahemla by a narrow strip of wilderness, which ran from the sea east even to the sea west, through the borders of Manti, by the head of River Sidon, running from the east to the west. So, the head of the Sidon River, whether you define head as a place of confluence or where it initially begins, is something. It's a place where the River Sidon runs from east to west. That does not describe anywhere in North America where the Mississippi or the Missouri rivers are. But the headwaters are up in the mountains of southwestern Guatemala and I'm talking about the Grijalva River here. The headwaters of the Grijalva River are up in the mountains of southwestern Guatemala And that river initially flows west into the southeastern Mexico area, and then it flows north being down into the Gulf of Mexico. This fits the description, the requirements of the Book of Mormon text. Up in the south and flowing in the proper direction. This works. There are no places in North America that work. None whatsoever. I wanted to next talk about large cities and cement houses and other similar things. Were there large cities in Mesoamerica, like are described in Helaman chapter 8, verses 5 and 6? And earlier in Ether chapter 9, verse 23, I'm talking about earlier in time, not chronologically, as you'd read through the Book of Mormon. The short answer is there were no large North American cities during Book of Mormon times. Zero. None. None were remotely large enough to match the descriptions of the cities in the Book of Mormon. The largest North American pre-Columbian Native American city was the Cahokia Mounds, now found in the Cahokia Mounds State Historic Site in the state of Illinois. It was first settled in about 600 AD, so realistically, this is after the end of the Book of Mormon narrative. But let's assume that maybe the dating's off and it was around for a few hundred years or so before the end of the Book of Mormon narrative. The number of people estimated at its peak to be at the Cahokia's largest population was somewhere around 10,000 to 30,000. And this was even later than the time that it was settled. Best guess is that it didn't have 10,000 to 30,000 until the 13th century AD. This was almost 600 years after the Book of Mormon period. At the end of the Book of Mormon times, there were 240,000 Nephites who died in the final battles alone. In other words, there were 85 times fewer inhabitants of Cahokia than the Nephites that died in the final battle. The numbers do not add up. The Cahokia State Mound, again, is the largest known city of Native Americans before Columbus came. Now let's ask, is there a city or cities that might work in Mesoamerica for such large populations? And the short answer is yes, there are many. Let's talk about some of these. One that shows the massive number of people is the Pyramid of the Sun in Teotihuacan, which was completed in about 100 AD. It is 738 feet wide and 246 feet high. To put this in comparison, this is taller by 6 feet than the LDS Church office building. It is less than 10 feet shorter than the Great Pyramid of Giza. This is a massive structure. And what does Teotihuacan mean? It means the city where men can become gods. it had a population of hundreds of thousands, according to archaeologists. And there are many, many other examples of large cities. The LIDAR scans that happened in 2018 was a major breakthrough and showed that the populations on the Yucatan Peninsula were vastly underestimated, and that during Book of Mormon times, there were probably more people living on the Yucatan Peninsula than lived in Europe, than lived in London and Paris and all of the surrounding areas combined, former people in Mesoamerica. So the population necessary to meet the requirements of the Book of Mormon descriptions is something that we do find in Mesoamerica, but not in North America. It's just not there. These new LIDAR laser scans showed more than 60,000 previously unknown houses, palaces, and elevated highways and other human-made features that have been hidden for centuries and centuries in the jungles of northern Guatemala. Quite a remarkable thing, a find that directly supports the Book of Mormon narrative as being in North America. Another fascinating point is the whole idea that's described of highways from city to city. Do we have the idea of highways being built in North America? We don't. Highways in North America are not something that were known or built by Native American populations. How about the ideas of cities of cement, houses of cement, as described in Helaman chapter 3, verses 7, 9, and 11. We don't have those in North America. We don't have any indication Native Americans in North America ever used cement. However, we do know that cement was in great use, high-quality cement was in great use in Mesoamerica during Book of Mormon times. There's been an ongoing, from time to time, archaeological excavation that's been jointly done by Harvard University, Catholic University of America, and Brigham Young University at a location called El Mirador on the Yucatan. Well, it's a little bit north and west of the Yucatan Peninsula. It's in southern Mexico, but it has cement structures. Almost everything in that entire city is made of cement. Some of the buildings are 5, 6, and 7 stories high. This was obviously a massive, massive complex, and one that fits the Book of Mormon narrative. There is nothing that even remotely fits the Book of Mormon narrative that can be found in North America. You just don't have any building with cement. Here is a very important one. Volcanic eruptions. We read in 3 Nephi, in chapter 8, a description that includes vapors of darkness. These vapors of darkness show that what was going on there was something that looked very much like like a volcanic eruption. And these volcanic eruptions are described in the Book of Mormon as being something that made it so that you couldn't light a fire. If you just had smoke, you could light a fire. If you had a hurricane, you could light a fire. But when you have a strong volcanic eruption, it makes it so thick and so dense that fires cannot be lit. That happened in and around Mount St. Helens and many other places. There are numerous volcanoes in and around the Yucatan Peninsula, the eruptions of which are dated to approximately the time of Christ. The number of volcanoes in northeastern United States? Zero. None. Now, if you looked at the West Coast, you'd still have a problem with Mount St. Helens and others dating an eruption to the right time period, but at least you would have a volcano. There are no volcanoes in the northeast United States. Here's an interesting one. We have descriptions in the Book of Mormon of the Nephites and Lamanites fighting with head plates and head shields. Alma 43, verse 19. A little later on in chapter 49, we hear about head plates and head shields. We also read in Alma chapter 43 about breastplates and arm shields and thick clothing. Does that sound like any descriptions of Native American warfare garb in North America? It does not. And yet we have many descriptions and actual paintings from a number of the codices and also from temple walls on the Yucatan Peninsula, which show Native American warriors with what could only be described as head shields, giant helmet-like structures being held up on stilts over their head to protect their head, presumably from enemies who were trying to fight them. The descriptions also include thick clothing and other things that just fit to a T the Book of Mormon descriptions. It's quite remarkable. One of the more amazing ones is at Palenque, dating to about 50 AD on Yucatan. Now, one could argue whether or not this is specifically part of the Book of Mormon people or not. That's not my point. The point here is that at Palenque, you clearly have in just beautiful pictures on the temples there, head shields depicted, and thick clothing, arms that are protected, body armor, those kinds of things. It's just fits to a T the Book of Mormon descriptions. All right, let's take another one, which I find fascinating. When you read in Alma the story of Ammon, as most people do, as they read through the Book of Mormon, you have this fascinating description where Ammon protects the flocks of the king. How does he do it? Well, when the bad guys come, I guess he could stab them. I guess he could fight them and cut them or, you know, whatever. But no, he hacks their arms off, which if you think about it, sounds a little bit bizarre. And then the story gets even a little bit more strange because what happens is that those who are seeing Ammon do this, gather up the severed arms and take them to the king, saying, see what this guy did? See what Ammon did? And they toss the pile of severed arms in front of the king. Now, that sounds extremely foreign to us. Severed arms as battle trophies or as witnesses or proof of some kind of battle victory. This is what we read in Alma chapter 17, verses 37 through 39. There is something that's a little bit similar that we read in Judges chapter 8, verse 6. It says, the officials of Succoth said, do you already have in your possession the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna that we should give bread to your army? Now, most people reading over that probably don't realize what that's describing, but it's saying, hey, do you have the severed hands of the armies of Zeba and Zalmunna so that your army can get paid? We also have a fascinating series of Egyptian descriptions that were carved in temple walls of piles of hands that were apparently battle trophies. This was apparently something that happened occasionally or often, we don't know, in the ancient Near East in connection with battles to prove what was accomplished. This is something we hear in Alma. It's something that was unknown in North America. If you had sort of fudged the description of what was going on here, you would have said, and Ammon took a whole bunch of scalps after he killed him. And then the scalps would have been taken out because that was the tradition in North America. But that's not what the Book of Mormon says. We also have this fascinating detail of a mural by Diego Rivera in 1886, who was known for meticulously researching his paintings. This painting is found in the National Museum in Mexico City. And it again shows a severed arm kept as battle trophies. In this particular case, there is a Mayan warrior who's trying to barter with the Lady of the Night and uses payment the severed arm of what would appear to be a Spaniard because the skin is very, very white. Apparently, this is something that happened and happened often. We don't have too much time left, so I just want to grab a couple of other examples as time permits here. We read in Mosiah chapter 9, verse 16, again in Alma chapter 2, verse 12, and in Alma chapter 43, verse 20, about Native Americans fighting with scimitars. What is a scimitar? Well, it is a sword that doesn't have a straight blade or even a slightly curved blade. It has kind of a hooked blade on the end. It's known in the Middle East. There are scimitars in Egypt, Iran, other places in the Middle East. There are zero scimitars that were used by Native Americans in North America, but there were scimitars used over a great time period in Mesoamerica. Fascinating. They were made of, typically of wood. They had obsidian edges rather than metal edges, but they are very, very clearly scimitars. This is something that to me has always been quite fascinating. Another interesting one, Ether chapter 10, verse 6 talks about elaborate thrones. Does anybody remember any North American, Native Americans having elaborate thrones for the chief of their tribe? I, for one, do not. And yet we find that both Olmec and Mayan kings had thrones, as depicted in a number of places in Mesoamerica. We also have a number of examples of Sacbej, which were white road in Mayan. These are white paved roads built by the Mayans to connect temples, plazas, cities, buildings. They were made of stone and then coated with white limestone stucco, and they were used to keep down the growth of the amazing tendency for plants to grow in Mesoamerica. We hear about roads being made which led from city to city, land to land, place to place in 3 Nephi chapter 6, verse 8. Do we read or know of roads being made by Native Americans in North America? I am unaware of that. If someone listening is aware, I would be very interested in hearing that. The last point that I have time for is about walled cities. We hear descriptions in many places about walled cities in the Book of Mormon. All over the place. Walled cities in connection with battles. Fortifications, walled cities. That's typically not the kind of thing that we find in North America. You just don't find Native Americans because they were more nomadic. Some lived in cities, but they did not have walls. We do find walls and moats around Palenque, which was a major city in Chiapas, Mexico, from about 100 BC to 800 AD. We read about these walled cities in Alma chapter 48, verse 8, in Alma 52, 6, and also in Helaman chapter 13. So to sum things up here, it's pretty clear to me that the overwhelming evidence for a location that fits the Book of Mormon descriptions for a geography are to be found in Mesoamerica, but not in North America. Now, perhaps all of that could change. I'm certainly open to changes and new information. But at this point in time, the amount of evidence that supports North America as a location for Book of Mormon events is very, very great. And the amount of evidence for North America is very, very small, and for Mesoamerica is very, very great. Stay tuned. I'm Martin Tanner. This is Interpreter Radio. We'll be back with Come Follow Me for Doctrine and Covenants 111 through 114 after this. Stay tuned.
You are listening to K-Talk Media, KBJA, AM 1640. Live, local, two-way talk.
Now, the Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
And we are back. This is Interpreter Radio. I'm Martin Tanner. Tonight we have just finished our first segment, which deals with Book of Mormon evidences, which overwhelmingly show that the likely location for the events in the Book of Mormon is Mesoamerica, not North America. And during this segment of our program, we will be talking about the Come Follow Me lesson for the week of October 4th through October 10th, 2021, sections 111 through 114, the title of which is I Will Order All Things for Your Good. Before jumping right into that lesson, wanted to mention that this program, the Interpreter Radio Show, is sponsored by the Interpreter Foundation, which you can find by a Google search or by going to interpreterfoundation.org. At that website, free, you will find Come Follow Me lessons, Interpreter Radio Show podcasts. You will also find scholarly articles, peer-reviewed articles that go back almost a decade now and cover a wide variety of subjects, all free and available for anyone. So if you have a question about some gospel issue or some other question about history or church leaders or doctrine, you are likely to be able to find the answer at interpreterfoundation.org. I'm Martin Tanner, your host. We also want to mention that this show is sponsored by LDSAgents.com, which is a wonderful network of a group of LDS realtors who can help you find a house that suits your needs anywhere in the continental United States or in Canada. So if you have such a need, try LDSAgents.com. They have your values. They can find a home or help you sell one. They have integrity. They'll do what they say. LDSAgents.com. Our Come Follow Me lesson this week, again, covers October 4th through 10th, 2021, sections 111 through 114, and the lesson name is I Will Order All Things for Your Good. Let's jump in and talk about these sections. These are kind of fun sections because they're unusual, and they also are impossible to really understand without diving in at least a little bit to the historical background, which I always like to do anyway. So for me, these are great fun. Let's talk about section 111. Section 111 is a fascinating example of how historical background can really help us get what's happening spiritually in a section of the Doctrine and Covenants. The context for section 111 is that the Kirtland Temple had been finished and dedicated in March of 1836, and that was a wonderful thing, but it also left the Kirtland Saints and the entire church, those who were in Missouri as well, impoverished. They were deeply in debt. They had massive financial problems. And the church was barely 6 years old. Joseph Smith, Sidney Rigdon, Oliver Cowdery, and Hiram had also left Kirtland in late July and they had traveled to Salem, Massachusetts. And this is the context for section 111. When they got to Salem, they rented a home. They preached the gospel publicly. They went sometimes knocking on doors from house to house. And it was while they were in Salem, Massachusetts, that section 111 was given. One of my favorite LDS leaders from early church history, B.H. Roberts, about the background of section 111 said this, quote, and by the way, this is from Comprehensive History of the Church, volume 1 at page 411. Quote, Ebenezer Robinson, for many years a faithful and prominent elder in the church and at Nauvoo associated with Don Carlos, brother of the prophet, in editing and publishing the Times and Season, states that the journey to Salem arose from circumstances like this. Quote, there came to Kirtland a brother by the name of Burgess, who stated that he had knowledge of a large amount of money secreted in a cellar, excuse me, secreted in the cellar of a certain house in Salem, Massachusetts. The money had belonged to a widow who had passed away, and this guy Burgess thought that he was the only person who had knowledge of it or of the location of the house. And so the brethren, accepting the representations of Mr. Burgess as true, made the journey to Salem, Massachusetts to secure, if possible, this treasure. Burgess met the brethren in Salem, but said that time had resulted in such changes in the town that he could not for certainty point out the house. And soon Burgess disappeared and left. Now that was quite a devastating result for the brethren who went up there. Church is in huge debt. They think, wow, we have a way to get some wealth, some treasure to pay off debts of the church. And yet that didn't happen. And here we read in the first few verses of section 111, the revelation that Joseph Smith received after these events. The Lord basically says that he's not displeased, notwithstanding your follies. In other words, if you take away the double negatives there, the Lord's still pleased with them, even though what they did was a folly. The prophet Joseph Smith's motives for going with William Burgess' suggestion that there was hidden treasure in Salem, his motives were good. He wasn't going for personal wealth. He was, as far as we know, solely motivated by his love for the saints and for the church and to get them out of debt. And to Joseph Smith and the other brethren, it appeared that in one incredible stroke of good luck, the church could get enough money to clear itself of debts. The elders and Joseph Smith had no thought of personal gain, and so presumably that's why the Lord was okay with what they did. But why then would the Lord call it a folly if he was not displeased with it? Why would he still describe it as a folly? Well, that would seem to be because less than 3 years earlier, Joseph Smith had received counsel from the Lord about the church's indebtedness. You take a look at section 104, starting in verse 78. You read that church members were told that they would humble themselves, if they would pray, if they would become closer to God, that they would be relieved of their indebtedness. The Lord would send a way for them to overcome the debt. But now, years later, they were still deeply in debt, and they were apparently not doing what the Lord had commanded them. Certainly, God could have instantly given them a way to pay their debts, but what had happened in the meantime, and the reason this was called folly, was that there were church members and even church leaders who, in order to get rid of their level of debt, sought speculative investments. In other words, risky investments. But the Lord was still okay with them going to Salem. Why? Well, the answer is that while they were there in Salem, as I mentioned, they preached the gospel, they went from door to door and taught a number of people, and their efforts resulted in a number of wonderful conversions. Elder Erastus Snow wrote in his own journal about their experiences in Salem. Here's what he said. Quote, "Until this time, July 6th of 1841, I had been calculating to spend the summer in the country and return home to Nauvoo in the late fall, in compliance with advice given to me by the President Joseph Smith when I left in November of last. But President Hiram Smith and William Law, who had been east as far as Salem, Massachusetts, had just returned through Philadelphia on their way home and said that I should not return to Nauvoo in the fall, but that I should go immediately with Brother Winchester to Salem, Massachusetts, and try to establish the kingdom in that city. They left with us a copy of a revelation given. And what was in that revelation? It talked about how the Word of God had brought them to a place where they could gather into the kingdom many people. And as a result of that, according to Elder Snow's journal entry, over 100 people had been baptized from the time they arrived in Salem till the time they returned to Nauvoo. That's an enormous number for that time period. There were plenty of people for a wonderful new branch. There were people who had been saved. So notwithstanding the fact that the brethren had gone to Salem for a reason that turned out to be folly, the result turned out to be good because many souls were saved, many joined the church. Now that brings us to a fascinating statement that we find in verse 4. When will the city of Salem be given to the saints, as verse 4 says, so that they will, quote, have power over it, close quote. Now, I don't know the answer to that question, but Sidney Sperry in his compendium makes this comment, quote, "In due time the Almighty will give Salem unto your hands, that the elders shall have power over it, inasmuch as they," probably meaning the people of the city, "shall not discover your shame referring to Isaiah. And then Elder Sperry goes on and says, quote, when that day comes, the elders of the church will govern even Salem without being shamed by the people of that city. Its wealth will also be theirs. The meaning here is that it will be used not so much for their own personal desires as for righteous purposes, close quote. I like Elder Sperry's thoughts here. Speculation though they are, it's a very reasonable speculation and makes sense. Verse 8 of section 111 has God directing his servants through the power of the Spirit. We know that righteous servants of God who seek God's help in their decisions can know that he approves of what they're doing through the whisperings of the Spirit to tell them that they're led by him. That appears to be what verse 8 is talking about. Now, verse 9 also has this curious reference to ancient inhabitants of Salem. Some people read that and think, oh, that must be early Native Americans or Lamanites or reference to something else in early times. B.H. Roberts said that the Lord's instructions to learn about the ancient inhabitants of Salem were, quote, doubtless having in view the securing of their genealogies and redemption of the past generations of men who had lived there. Close quote. That's from History of the Church, Volume 1, Verse 412. Now, another fascinating comment here is from Smith and Sajil's commentary. And if you want a reference here, it's at 729, page 729, that the ancient inhabitants more particularly refers to the ancestors of the prophet Joseph Smith. This revelation was given at Salem, the county seat of Essex County, Massachusetts, and it was in that county that Robert Smith, the first of the Smith family in America, settled. It was the residence of many more of the pioneer immigrants to America whose descendants joined the church. At Salem, the county seat, the records for all the towns in the county were kept, and the Smith family records, among many others of the saints, were found there. And so the matter of genealogy, of family history, as we would now describe it, apparently was the point of this phrase, ancient inhabitants, for a purpose, which was manifest later in connection with the salvation of the dead. Remember, at the time this revelation was given, revelations about baptism for the dead were still in the future. And yet, this revelation foreshadows those ordinances. I find that fascinating. It's a wonderful element of truth there that shows that God is behind section 111. Let's take a look next at section 112, which is the word of the Lord to the 12 apostles. Before section 112 was received, Joseph Smith recorded in his journal that Kirtland was experiencing contention, disunity, apostasy, financial speculation, all of which had combined to cause the Kirtland Safety Society, which was essentially a banking institution, even though it was labeled as an anti-banking institution, it led to its failure, its collapse. Now, in historical context, there are many people who say this meant horrible mismanagement and so on and so forth. Well, that's not entirely true. It certainly contributed to the problem, but this was a time of great financial unrest in the country. And approximately half of all banking institutions in the United States failed during this time period. So this is not unusual, although it is tragic that it was a financial institution that was associated with the church. Quote, in this state of things, and but with a few weeks before the 12 were expecting to meet in full quorum, some of them having been absent for some time, God revealed to me, this is Joseph Smith, that something new must be done for the salvation of his church. In honor about the 1st of June, 1837, he received Kimball, one of the 12, was set apart by the spirit of prophecy and prayer and revelation and laying on of hands of the first presidency to preside over a mission to England to be the first foreign mission of the Church of Christ in the last days, close quote. Volume 2, History of the Church, page 489. Now this to be is also a fabulous example of how God knows far more than people do, and far more than our meager and foolish logic might suggest. Let me say what I mean when I say that. So here we have the Kirtland Safety Society. The church is in financial disarray. People are murmuring against Joseph Smith, even other church leaders. Joseph Smith prays, saying, help, help, what should we do? And God says, start a mission to England. That's probably one of the last things that would enter into anyone's mind. And yet, it, of course, worked. Why did it work? Because it redirected the thoughts of the saints and its leaders. It also started an influx of many saints with great abilities to bolster the church in Kirtland and also in Missouri, and to help the saints that were there, both financially and otherwise. About this time period, Joseph Fielding Smith later wrote, quote, the day that the British missionaries preached the first sermons in England, July 23, 1837, the Lord gave a revelation to the prophet Joseph Smith, directed to Thomas B. Marsh as president of the Council of the Apostles. In this revelation, Elder Marsh was instructed to teach the brethren in his council and point out to them their duty and responsibilities in proclaiming the gospel. Some of the apostles had forsaken their responsibilities and had turned their attention to schemes of speculation. The years preceding the year 1837 were years of wild speculation throughout the United States. And Elder Heber C. Kimball pointed out how this boom had struck Kirtland, and some of the brethren had borrowed great sums and had gone into business at the expense of their ministry. And when the bubble of false prosperity broke, they were left financially stranded. Then they began to blame the prophet Joseph Smith. This revelation to Thomas Marsh was a warning and a call to him to bring his brethren back into the line of their duty as apostles of Jesus Christ, close quote. Source for that quote is Church History and Modern Revelation, Volume 2, verse 71, and also History of the Church, Volume 2, starting on page 498. The first 12 verses of Section 112 are directed to Thomas B. Marsh, giving him comfort, counsel, and admonition. The rest of the section contains instructions that he was to give to the 12. So the next question is, and I guess if we move back to verse 1 of Section 112, we have to ask, who were Thomas B. Marsh's brethren? The answer to this is that on February 14th of 1835, the First Quorum of the Twelve was organized. Its members were chosen to be special witnesses of the Savior throughout the world, and the Twelve were arranged in seniority according to age. It's a little different from the way we do it now. Today it's according to date of ordination. Then it was according to age. Elder Thomas B. Marsh, being the oldest, was the president of the quorum and thus responsible for the other 11. In verse 6, we have this fascinating comment, and it deals with the idea of thy habitation be known in Zion. What does that phrase mean? This is directed at Thomas B. Marsh. Well, the answer is that in 1832, Thomas Marsh received an inheritance. It was about 30 acres. It was on the Big Blue River, Missouri. And at that location on his property, he built a nice log home. Not extravagant, but nice. And when the Saints were driven from Jackson County, he went to Lafayette County and sought refuge. In 1834, he too went to Clay County. After an extended visit to Kirtland, he returned home on Fishing River to his home. In 1836, he built a house in Far West. In June of 1837, he again visited Kirtland. It was necessary for the success of his mission that his residence in Zion should be known and that his house should not be moved. That's the answer to why that odd phrase, thy habitation be known in Zion, apparently was there. One of the other fascinating comments about Thomas Marsh is in verse 7, where it says that he's going to serve missions to many nations. Well, the prophet Joseph Smith, along with Sidney Rigdon and Thomas B. Marsh, started for Canada on a mission. You can read about that in Volume 2 of the History of the Church, starting on page 502. How that mission ultimately did not happen. And eventually what we see is that, no, Thomas Marsh did not witness to a number of other nations. This prophecy for his future was not realized. The main reason I believe that it wasn't realized is because, like all prophecies about the future, they are contingent upon our faithfulness. And Marsh, Elder Marsh, later apostatized and left the church. He is described in verses 8 and 9 as a powerful speaker. So the question is raised occasionally by critics, well, was Marsh really a powerful speaker? And would it be more than speculation to say that he was? Smith and Sajal, in their commentary on page 733, have this quote that shows that indeed Marsh was an eloquent speaker. Quote, he was a member of a committee selected to pass resolutions on behalf of the exiled saints at a meeting at the City of Liberty. And on that occasion, he spoke of the persecution of the saints that they had suffered so eloquently that General Acheson and others in the congregation wept. Close quote. That verse is correct. Elder Marsh was a very eloquent speaker. Here's the next verse that perhaps we ought to mention here. In verses 11 and 12, a charge is made to pray for and to admonish the 12. What does it mean here to admonish? And in what way were they supposed to be admonished? Well, the Lord instructs the president of the council to pray for the members of the Council of the Twelve and to admonish them with prayer. Orson Hyde, who had been involved with the spirit of speculation, because he was admonished with prayer and properly, freely acknowledged his faults and asked for forgiveness. Parley P. Pratt, too, at one time was overcome with the spirit of strife, and he says, quote, I went to Brother Joseph in tears and with a broken heart and contrite spirit confessed wherein I had erred, and he frankly forgave me and prayed for me and blessed me. Close quote. Others weren't quite like that. For example, Luke Johnson, John Boynton, Lyman Johnson were eventually disfellowshipped from the church. Not long, just a few months after that revelation was given. Let's move on to verse 14. We're going to run out of time if we don't. What does it mean to take up your cross? Isn't this kind of a strange comment? Take up your cross? Well, I thought that we were supposed to focus on the idea of Joseph Smith's atonement, not the cross, not his crucifixion. Well, this phrase, take up the cross, is addressed by Joseph Smith in his so-called translation of the Bible, the Joseph Smith translation. I like to describe it more as an inspired reworking or expansion of the Bible, because I think that is a better description. But be that as it may, the Joseph Smith translation of the Bible says this. If you go to Matthew chapter 16, verses 25 and 26, it says, quote, and now, for a man to take up his cross is to deny himself all ungodliness and every worldly lust and keep my commandments. Close quote. That tells us what it means to take up your cross for each one of us. In other words, just as the cross for Jesus was an incredibly difficult and excruciating thing to do, we are supposed to do things that are incredibly excruciating and difficult for us by focusing on what's right rather than on what our personal desires may wish. Verse 15 of section 112. Will Joseph Smith always hold the keys? This is a fascinating one because it kind of seems to be counterintuitive. Joseph Fielding Smith described what this phrase means. Quote, at the time this revelation was given, some of the members of the Council of the Apostles were in open rebellion and had displayed a very bitter spirit towards the prophet. The Lord endeavored to impress upon them the fact that the prophet was the one who held the keys of this dispensation, and that he would hold them constantly until the Lord should come. Now, that does not mean that subsequent presidents of the church haven't held the keys. Joseph Smith's position as president of the church means that he has certain keys of this dispensation that are in addition to those of being prophet, seer, and revelator of the church. Brigham Young made this fascinating comment. Quote, Joseph Smith also held the keys of this dispensation, and these keys will never be taken from him. The keys of the priesthood were committed to Joseph to build up the kingdom of God on earth and were not to be taken from him in time or in eternity. Close quote. Discourses of Brigham Young, page 138. So, in a sense, every prophet holds the keys, and yet Joseph Smith holds the keys of this dispensation, and they will never be taken away from him. All right. I always take too long. Let's go to a couple of final thoughts here, and then on to section 113. Why in section 112, verses 17, 18, and 19, would it say that the 12 was supposed to be directing the first presidency? It says the 12 are to carry the work into all the worlds as directed by the first presidency. Well, the answer to this is that it's not possible for the first presidency to do everything. They have to delegate. They have to direct the 12. And so it's not inconsistent at all for that to happen. All right, and I have many other things for section 112, but we'll move on in the interest of time. Let's take a look at section 113. There's some great things in section 113. The background for section 113 is that in January of 1838, Prophet Joseph Smith left Kirtland to escape his enemies. They were trying to kill him. They weren't just after him to argue with him. They were out to do him violence, to take his life. He traveled to Far West, where he arrived on March 14th of 1838. And on that day he wrote, quote, on the 14th day of March, as we were about entering Far West, many of the brethren came out to meet us, who also with open arms welcomed us to their bosoms. We were immediately received under the hospitable roof of Brother George W. Harris, who treated us with all possible kindness. And we refreshed ourselves with much satisfaction after our long and tedious journey, the brethren bringing in such things as we had need of for our comfort and convenience. Close quote. History of the Church, Volume 3, starting at page 8. The prophet also included in his history, at this point in time, some answers from the Lord to questions that he and others apparently had about the book of Isaiah. Although we don't, I say apparent, because we don't know if all the questions were Joseph Smith's, if some were from others, or what the mix is, but we do know that there were questions about Isaiah, and that Joseph Smith received answers. Now, it's fascinating that what we now have, the section 113, was first published in the Doctrine and Covenants in the 1876 edition. Was added by Brigham Young. So this is one of those sections that was not around for quite a while. Joseph Smith, of course, being killed in 1844. This is over 30 years later. Let's take a look at verses 1 and 2. Why would Christ be referred to as the stem of Jesse? The Hebrew word translated into English in the King James Bible as stem means the stock or the major root which remains in the earth after a tree is cut down. And so literally interpreted or translated into English, into today's English, we might read Isaiah a little bit different. It might say, there shall come forth a branch from the severed trunk of Jesse, and indeed a shoot shall come from the roots that are left, and those roots shall bear fruit in the form of a shoot. That's kind of what's meant here. The branch and the stem both seem to refer to Jesus, and then we get to the question in verses 3 through 6 of section 113, who are the rod and the roots spoken of by Isaiah? Most Latter-day Saints who read this assume the rod was Joseph Smith. And they would also assume, I suppose, that believing that Joseph Smith was modest, hesitated to name himself directly here. Now, maybe that's true. We might also assume that he was the rotter's servant for a number of other reasons that fit in with Moroni's mission and his visit to Joseph Smith. Because we have descriptions, according to Moroni in his mission, about the rod or servant in the hands of Christ. Joseph Smith seems to fit this quite well. If you take a look at Joseph Smith history, verse 40, it sort of gives credence to that inference. Despite this conclusion, there's still this feeling that I occasionally have, and I'm sure others do as well, that it might be good to have better proof that Joseph Smith really is the guy, really is the rod that's mentioned here. And there is some far better proof or some supporting proof. If we take a look here at section 113, verses 5 and 6, where it says, quote, in order to assess this explanation intelligently, let us turn to Isaiah 11:10. Quote, a closer translation of the original may be given here. And it shall come to pass that in that day that the root of Jesse that standeth for an ensign of the peoples, unto him shall the nations seek. And his resting place or refuge shall be glorious. Here, quite obviously, the root of Jesse is a man and a descendant of Jesse and of Joseph, who seems to have a great mission to perform in connection with the gathering of Israel in the last days, according to Isaiah 11, starting in verse 11. This seems to refer pretty directly to Joseph Smith. As a matter of fact, I can't think of anyone else to whom it could easily refer. Joseph Smith holds the priesthood and its keys, therefore by lineage, and no one also disputes the fact that he was chosen by Peter, James, and John and Moroni, and by Jesus himself in a number of appearances, along with God the Father, to be the prophet of the restoration. And so, in that sense, we seem to have a pretty clear indication that indeed Joseph Smith is the one referred to here in section 113. According to Bruce R. McConkie, quote, this designation signifies that he who was the son of David was also before David and preeminent above him, and was the root or source of which the great king in Israel gained his kingdom and power. Close quote. The explanation of Isaiah 11, verse 10, given in Doctrine and Covenants 113, that's the one we're reading today, implies that while Christ is the root of David, he is not the root of Jesse mentioned by Isaiah. There are two reasons for this conclusion. First, the Lord, through the prophet Joseph Smith in verse 2, identifies Christ as the stem of Jesse. He does not identify Christ as the root of Jesse. Second, verse 6 indicates that the root of Jesse is a servant of Christ to whom keys are given in the last days to gather Christ's people. Now that means that it has to be referring to Joseph Smith. So next let's talk about verses 9 and 10 in verse 11. That is about the gathering of Israel. During the early era of the church, most people believed that the lost tribes had all left together in a group and moved north. There were three different ideas about where they were located. One was that they were in a hollow cave or cavern at the North Pole, which was warm, and that at the appropriate time, God would tell them when to return. They would come up through this cavern or hole at the North Pole and come back south. Problem with that is there is no earth at the North Pole. That theory was a theory that just doesn't work. There's nothing but water, frozen water at the North Pole. The second theory was that the lost tribes were at some specific location that had been taken away from the earth out of the Gulf of Mexico. That one also has largely been discarded by Latter-day Saints today. The third one that was believed in the early days of the church is that the lost tribes were scattered hither and yon in all different directions, but mostly north at the time of the scattering. That would place them many places in Europe. The thing that confirms that for us today is that you have patriarchal blessings that show every single tribe. And so all of these tribes aren't lost, they are just scattered and part of many different locations and have intermingled through the millennia with a number of different races and people and ethnic populations. All right, let's talk about our final section in our last 5 minutes, section 114. This is a revelation given specifically to David W. Patton at Far West, Missouri. It was given on April 17th of 1838. If you'd like a little bit broader description of the background, go to History of the Church, Volume 3, verse 23. Elder Patton was one of the original apostles. He had been living in Missouri and with Elder Marsh was maintaining a steady influence amidst the opposition of disaffected brethren. In other words, he was murmuring against Joseph Smith and others. And that's not a good thing. The Lord called upon Elder Patton to settle up his business as soon as possible and prepare to go on a mission. And this revelation says, quote, "For verily thus saith the Lord, that inasmuch as there are those among you who deny my name, others shall be planted in their stead and receive their bishopric." Amen. So what does bishopric mean here? Well, more about that in a minute, but the gist of it means in this context, because bishopric had a wider meaning than it does today, that it meant stewardship. It meant stewardship of your priesthood calling. Elder Patton was obedient to this revelation. He took steps to meet his call, which had come to him. But there were some serious events that would change the nature of his mission before spring could happen. In October of 1838, persecutions of mobs in Missouri increased, and Joseph Smith told Elder Patton to lead 75 volunteers against a mob of 30 or 40. Hoping to rout them without bloodshed so that they could free some prisoners who were being held. And in that confrontation, Elder David W. Patton was shot in the stomach and died that night. The prophet Joseph Smith said about Elder David W. Patton, quote, "He was one of the 12 apostles and died as he had lived, a man of God, and strong in the faith of a glorious resurrection, in a world where mobs will have no place." Close quote. In other words, Elder Patton had his mission opportunities taken away from him by a mob who killed him. Section 114 is another of the sections that was placed in the Doctrine and Covenants later, much later, again in 1876 by Brigham Young. And there's this fascinating photo that I have in my small little collection of photos about that shows a black and white photo of Crooked River, where David W. Patton was shot fatally. It's quite a reminder that the sacrifice that was made by many of the early saints was truly, truly great. Let me close with this. The Doctrine and Covenants has some marvelous, marvelous insights and revelations that are applicable for us as much as they were to the people for whom they were specifically revealed. We are to liken all scriptures unto ourselves. I strongly suggest that everyone who is involved in teaching from the Doctrine and Covenants look very closely at the historical background, because that gives the entire context and helps greatly with an understanding. I can leave you with my testimony and strong personal belief that Joseph Smith was an inspired prophet, and that the Doctrine and Covenants, along with the Book of Mormon and the Bible, Old and New Testaments, are inspired works, inspired by God. And I would also, again, close with the idea that hopefully those of you who are interested will take advantage of the many things that the Interpreter Foundation has to offer. Go to interpreterfoundation.org to find Come Follow Me lessons and to also find radio podcasts and scholarly articles. Join me next time I'm on the rotation here for Interpreter Radio. Join us every Sunday from 7 to 9 p.m. right here on KTalk Media. Good night.